I wish I was a mole in the ground. Yes, I wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. You are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. This is listener-supported community radio. It is time now for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Denise Morris, your host for this October 3rd Monday. Patricia Kohlberg is our engineer. This morning on the Old Mole, Bill Resnick talks with Teresa Rayford, a leader of Don't Shoot Portland. They talk about the growing impunity of police, racist vigilantes, and the importance of street protests challenging this violence, and that business as usual by police and civilian racists will continue until it's forced to change. Desiree Helgers interviews Dan Handelman of Portland Cop Watch about the upcoming city council vote on the draft police association contract, which was released by the mayor's office on Friday. The contract, which will not be up for renegotiation until 2020, will have important bearing on police accountability in Portland. And Laurie Messier talks with Michael Harriet. Michael Harriet is a writer, a podcaster, a spoken word poet, and editor-in-chief of Negus Who Read. In 2013, he began hosting the Black One podcast, and it has grown to become one of the most listened to podcasts in Black America. And we'll link to his website and to an article that he had written recently in Ebony. They will discuss Black Americans, gun control, and police violence. And that will conclude our show. We are, as you can see, focusing on police violence today. I am Denise Morris for the Old Mole Variety Hour. Thanks for tuning in this morning, and thanks to KBOO members, old and new, for supporting KBOO and programs like the Old Mole Variety Hour, 20 years and counting. And remember, you can find us on the web. Look for the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO's own website, kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour. And now, Bill Resnick and Teresa Rayford.
Teresa Rayford, welcome to KBOO again.
Well, good morning, Bill. Thank you.
Teresa Rayford is a great activist in Portland with Don't Shoot Oregon. Is it Don't Shoot Oregon or Don't Shoot Portland?
Don't Shoot Portland, but
don't
you're giving me ideas.
Don't Shoot Portland, but it's for all of Oregon and, in fact, the country. They're active in, quote, criminal justice reform. It's a rotten system, and all of it has to be really radically changed. Don't Shoot Portland and many affiliated groups have, and Don't Shoot United States and Black Lives Matter and many affiliated groups have created a movement for Black Lives. It issued a wonderful statement of the kinds of demands that are necessary to not just enable Blacks and people of color to come out from what is really an oppressive state for most people, but also white people. It's a change in the economic and social system that they're demanding. I think it's going to get a lot of traction in the next couple of years. We'll be talking about that. That is the larger demands for jobs and housing and many other changes, protection of poor, vulnerable workers. It's quite a substantial and wonderful document that people might look for. First, Teresa, let's talk about what happened last week. There were two shootings of unarmed Black men, other shootings as well. The ones in Charlotte and Tulsa have gotten the most media play. On very short notice, that is a couple of days, Don't Shoot Portland scheduled a march. Tell us why it's so important to keep marching.
Well, basically, Bill, when we do our protest, it's a call to action. It's in solidarity with the families and the community members that are fighting the police brutality and the circumstances in which they're thrown into because of the state war against Black people. And so when we did the protest, and I know that you're like, oh, it's very short notice. Well, we wanted to wait until there was a need for a demand. And the need for the demand came when the community there in Charlotte was basically asking for the videos. They were asking to have the video released to the public, and we knew that the video was going to be released of Keith Scott being murdered to his family. But they were also saying that the community needed to see it. And not only were we protesting in solidarity to uplift his name and bring the humanity to the person that was murdered by police, but also to show solidarity and to demand that those videos be released and to also bring awareness back into our own city about the police violence and the white supremacy and the systems that bind us. And especially at a time like now, where we have a collective bargaining agreement on the table dealing directly with police brutality. And so timing is everything.
You have to keep the pressure on, or the killing, it just becomes another daily fact, as it was like 20 years ago when there was even more police killing.
Yeah.
But there weren't video cameras that began showing it, everybody with a camera. A lot of the evidence was only the police testimony. Now, when that video's begun to be shown, I think that was an important part of it.
Like the Rodney King
beating. For most, even white liberals, they had no idea of how horrible in these imprisoned areas, white and black, where police had complete impunity.
Yep.
Basically, poorly paid people everywhere, with a huge predominance, of course, of black people who were segregated into their own little prison gulags.
Well, as you notice with the protests, we promote the filming of police. At the protests on Friday, we had to continuously say, film the police, because we didn't understand why riot cops and SWAT gear and with guns and all types of military equipment were showing up to a protest where they knew it was going to be predominantly families and children and people with disabilities. I mean, again, our police state and whatever system of control is basically using the physical force of police officers to create a fear for community members, but at the same time saying it's important for us to engage with them. It's chaotic to me.
Yeah, I saw a lot of video of the Charlotte marches on establishment media, and their primary story was, oh, this march is without violence. And then, of course, there's these robocops showing up all over.
With the violence.
And with the violence. But even if there's no violence at all, even if not one garbage can is put on fire, and you can be sure when a garbage can gets on fire, it gets on the news. Well, there was violence at this one. That their whole rhetoric is it violent or not? Which, of course, is a statement is these black people are violent people.
And it's sickening because they're saying that when we hurt an object or when someone injures an object, that's more violent than the death of our children, and they know that's what we're out there fighting for. Mayor Hills brought that up the other day in City Hall, and I thought it was a disgusting time to bring in that type of rhetoric. We had children, we had families, we had people that had never been to City Hall before that walked several hours from Northeast Portland to bring their grievance to their mayor. And we got there, and he tried to chastise those community members and whoever followed us in there as allies and accomplices and whatever we needed to make it happen. He chastised them about graffiti, and he knew that they were in there because of the blood of dead children. He knew that we were in there speaking the name of Keith Scott and Terrence Crothers. He knew that. You know, he knew that we've been talking about Keaton Otis and Kendra James and Aaron Campbell and all of the people that were killed here in our own community. But he decided to bring up vandalism. And that's one of the things that we have to break. The state is being appropriate in their response to black people because they're protecting things and property. And it's violent for us to be in those spaces. They don't want us in those spaces. You know, it's sickening, but we have to change those things. Those are all policy things.
That's part of it. We talked earlier again about the current climate and the way that black bodies now inspire fear, and it's happening, and the fear is being promoted in the most obvious ways by people like Trump. But the fear is promoted everywhere, so we can have Michael Jordan, Tiger Woods, as being the most beloved athletes of the century. White kids, white men, white racists.
Love them.
Love them.
They're games, they're toys, they're objects. They're not people to them, because as soon as they get on their knee or they demand that they don't stand for the anthem, then of course they want to lynch them. Trump is American as apple pie. He is what America is. He's not brand new. He's not teaching us anything that we didn't already know. He's exposing it, and people are attaching themselves to it because they want to be that. I mean, we've used propaganda in our country to make it seem like we can associate ourselves with humanity, but that's a damn lie, and you know it. Yeah. All of us know it. When the United Nations is suggesting that we stop killing our unarmed citizens, when you have countries that don't even have a percentage of the murders that we have from our law enforcement to citizens to people that live here, we're talking about children. And we're not just talking about black people. We have a problem. 708 people have been killed by law enforcement as of today, unless, well, I think there was one killed in Houston today.
Yeah, we're talking about killing now, but I think we have to broaden it. Obviously, the prison system.
The prison system, our community policing,
the way the
social
courts
services.
Work, the way the prosecuting attorneys work, the sentencing system, more and more police in schools.
Yes.
The country is moving towards this utter police state, particularly for black people. And the amount of number of people in prison, black people in prison, not just people given the death penalty, but people serving life without parole, 10 times the number of those
people. Look at how many people are in jail for nonviolent offenses, and they're looking at 15 to 25 years.
It's horrible to really see it, although let me challenge one thing. That's one face of the country. There's another face of the country. There are a lot of white people and brown people and mixed people who are appalled and frightened, but in fact don't know the depth of it and are insufficiently active and not part of movements. And then there's a lot of people who are part of movements that are ineffective. It seems to me that there is the possibility of ultimately rallying against not just the police state, but the vigilante state.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about, though, the vigilante state
yes.
that's being set up.
Well, let's get on that, because in honor of Larnell Bruce, who was killed here in Oregon by a white supremacist last month, and, you know, they just re-indicted him after our protest on September 11th on hate crime charges. Most of the work that we've been doing in solidarity with the prison strike has been to look out for the safety of those that are incarcerated and also to hold law enforcement accountable for taking these complaints of racial injustice or bias or assaults or harassment or intimidation seriously, because they haven't been tracking them. They haven't used them to lead to safer communities. They haven't used them to expose the white supremacy and the retaliation that could be enforced using informants or non-people of color to, you know, assassinate or to cause problems and havoc in our communities. There's been no force of action against those type of gangs, but there's this entire country that is serving to force of action against black community members that live in poverty, and we identify them as gangs. We're leaving a whole wide circuit wide open. In the same community where Larnell Bruce was killed, they had white supremacist KKKs distributing information to community members, recruiting them. And we know that that's a known hate organization, but the police in our state were saying that that's something that should be ignored. When they rally at the Capitol, or when they burned Kate Brown's, a fake image of her at the Capitol the other day, they're not sending out riot cops to those type of people. And so they know that we're vulnerable. The black community is very vulnerable to vigilantism of all sorts, because what media has said is that if a black body is murdered, then it's obvious that another black person has pulled that trigger or put the lynch around that neck. And that's not the truth. We know that there's people that are accommodating themselves to violence because of the work that's being
done. Yeah, we're talking to Teresa Rayford, who is spent how many years now, Teresa?
6 years today.
6 years today, trying to expose the dirty underbelly, the way in which America is becoming more and more hostile and murderous towards black people and other people who they consider black and worthless, regardless of their color. Teresa, let's get back to the vigilante problem and the rise of a white supremacy movement, a particularly virile anti-black movement. There was an incident in Northeast Portland recently where three young children were sprayed with bear spray by some white guy who then drove away. Tell us, they were the kids of a doctor at OHSU.
And they don't want to be there. pretty anonymous as a family, but it's not a doctor's family. She is a person that actually is employed there. And her children were, you know, in their community saying goodbye to their family member, their grandmother. And this is all in the news already. But he rode up on a bike, got off of his bike, was yelling racial slurs at the children, and then commenced to grabbing a bear spray can and spraying inside of the car where the children were buckled into their seatbelts. And when the family called to the police, and again, this is in the media as well, when the family called, the response was mostly like, what kind of kids are they and what do they do in the community? And there wasn't more of an urgence in getting a description of this person or collecting the tools that fell off of his bike so that they could, you know, look for possible fingerprints or do any type of investigation. It was more about, what were the kids doing wrong? And that's a norm.
Why was this guy justified in bear spraying? They were they were beginning the way they ask about crime about killing investigations. Well, what distinguished this person?
These are children, and these are children. Who would ask that question?
It's bizarre.
It's not bizarre to me because I've been out here advocating for families for years. And like I told you, when Shaquita Lewis was talking about her daughter, Yashani Vaughn, being missing and saying, look, she's not coming home, they didn't even want to look for the little girl. They kept on saying, she's a runaway. She's a thug. This is ghetto. They didn't even want to respond until the family was saying, we're going to protest the police station. They don't take black crime when we're complaining about something, when we're calling the police. They keep saying they want to come in our community. They want to hang out in our schools. They want to be more engaged with us. When we call them and there's a problem, they do not take it as a problem. They take it as an opportunity to investigate the family. They take it as an opportunity to share information with other agencies, to dismantle that family, and to criminalize that family. And that is something that is so out of order. It is so out of order, and we don't have leaders fighting against that. But it, again, leaves us vulnerable.
Bill Resnick here for the Old Mole, talking to Teresa Rayford. Teresa, first, you're going to be talking to Charlie Hales. One of the good things about the march this Friday was you forced him to, in fact, discuss what the city is doing. If this is going to stop, and if we're going to change, we're going to do, quote, reform, real reform, there's going to have to be a really large movement of people of color and lots of whites.
Yeah.
And it seems to me we really have to build that movement. You talked earlier about, I sort of challenged you, that racism and violence are like apple pie, part of America. But it seems to me there's another America, it seems to me, that is going to have to be organized and stand up, who I believe stand for very different principles and life ways, including environmental justice. There's huge there's really large numbers of people out there who recognize how rotten it really is.
They have to continue recognizing that in intersectionality, when we talk about recognizing things, we cannot acquiesce. We can never acquiesce. When we're dealing with epidemics in this country, if it was a physical disease, we would all be researching it. We would be looking for ways to beat it. We would be trying to knock it out. We need to do the same thing with racism and state-sanctioned discrimination from where we stand. When we're talking about the Vote Black platform and how it recognizes the movement for Black lives, what we're asking for is elected politicians and those running for office to connect with us so that we can discuss these issues. We have to have a voice. They have to come to our table.
Yeah, it also, though, talks about the absolute need for jobs programs for all of these young whites and blacks who are left without hope, who are not going to, in fact, be able to compete with those with money and support and schools that are well-funded. They're stuck at the bottom, and some of them go bad. One of the great things about that agenda, at least for me, is it talks also about housing. It talks about policy and how to dismantle. It talks about the drug wars, the prison pipeline, the need to develop affordable housing, to support cooperatives even, and Black economic and other development. Anyway, Teresa, thanks so much for talking to us today. I was Teresa Rayford.
Thank you, Bill.
This is a public service announcement. With guitar! Know your rights! All three of them! Number one!
Trails of troubles, rows of battles, paths of victory we shall walk. The road is dusty, the road is mighty rough. Better road is waiting, the day is not far off. Trails of trouble, rows of battles, paths of victory we shall walk. I walked down by the river, I turned my head up high, I saw that silver lining that was hanging in the sky. Well, I saw trails of trouble, rows of battles, paths of victory we shall walk. The gravel road is a bumpy, a little harder road to ride. There's a clearer road awaiting, with the cinders on the other side. Oh, we got trails of a trouble, and we got rows of a battle, paths of a victory we shall walk. Evening train was a rolling, a humming of the wheels. I saw a better day as I looked across the field. Well, I saw trails of troubles, rows of battles, paths of victory we shall walk. The trail is dusty, the road is mighty rough. A good road awaiting, oh, the day is not far off. Oh, we got trails, trails of trouble, and we got our roads, roads of a battle, paths of victory we shall walk.
That is Odetta covering Bob Dylan's Paths of Victory. We're using music today, of course, to help us tell the story of struggle and the vision for liberation. As music has always played an important role in our movements, and particularly now with the increased visibility of police violence in Black communities, lots of great music coming out and lots of folks speaking out. We'll later in our program actually hear from Michael Harriet. Laurie Mercier, our old mole, will talk with him about his work as a writer, podcaster, and a poet. But next up, we'll hear Desiree Helgers, who interviews Dan Handelman, and they're talking about Dan Handelman is with Portland Cop Watch. And they're talking about the upcoming police association contract being negotiated. Desiree?
So my guest today is Dan Handelman of Portland Cop Watch and Peace and Justice Works. And we're talking today about the latest developments with the police association contracts in Portland. So, Dan, can you fill us in a little bit about what happened this last week?
Well, just as background, Mayor Hales, who's the police commissioner and who is what they call a lame duck, he's being replaced by Ted Wheeler in January, started negotiating this contract in May behind closed doors and didn't ask anybody in the community what we thought he should do while he was sitting down to negotiate it. And the draft contract came out on Friday, a week ago, giving us 5 days to read the contract and come to city council and give our opinions. So what happened on Wednesday was the council was considering whether to approve the contract, and dozens of people came and testified against it. The ACLU, the National Lawyers Guild, Portland Cop Watch, the NAACP, the AMA Coalition for Justice and Police Reform had sent in a statement.
Don't Shoot Portland.
Don't Shoot Portland. It was a very important part of it because Don't Shoot Portland was in the middle of occupying City Hall after having demanded that Charlie Hales talk to them about why Black Lives Matter, and he set up a meeting with them, then kind of did a bait and switch and moved the meeting. And so they were actually literally occupying the front of City Hall. They had a banner up across the front columns of City Hall, and a bunch of them came in to support the testimony because we all are in solidarity with each other.
And Black Lives Matter Vancouver was there, too. I just want to
add. Oh, good, good, good. And Teresa spoke as one of the speakers who was up front talking about why we need to delay this implementation of the contract. And so the issues that came up included that they are removing the 48-hour rule, which is a rule that lets police officers take 2 days between the time they shoot somebody and the time they're compelled to talk to the police in an internal investigation. This is not for the criminal investigations. This is to see if they broke the policy. People have been yelling and screaming at the city about that rule for years, and so it's a good thing they're taking that out, but they're not really getting anything else changed in terms of accountability. And last year, when the city presented to Judge Simon about the Department of Justice agreement, the city attorney said, we're not even using the 48-hour rule. We're asking the officers to come in voluntarily, and they come in, you know, 3-4 days after the shooting. So it's like there's already more longer than a 48-hour waiting period, and they're not using this thing to compel the officers to testify. So they're getting rid of something that's not even being used. Meanwhile, what the police are getting is they're getting raises. They're getting the ability to get hired back on the force after they've retired and basically double dip. And there's all sorts of seniority things that are in there that, it's a huge number of financial benefits. And we don't say that workers shouldn't negotiate for good salaries and benefits. That's what, the progressive community stands for. But when they start setting public policies about things, that's where the problem is. So embedded in the contract, and what they didn't address, is that when an officer is fired, that it goes to binding arbitration. And what that's gotten us in Portland is, time and again, the arbitrators are biased and put the officer back on the force. The most recent example is Ron Frashauer, who killed Aaron Campbell in 2010. So they didn't do anything to change that clause. There are also several clauses about our oversight system that say the oversight system can't compel the officer's testimony, they can't investigate deadly force cases, and if the citizen doesn't like the outcome of the investigation in a deadly force case, they can't appeal that to the Citizen Review Committee. And what makes it even more aggravating that they didn't address any of those things is the director of the Independent Police Review Division testified to City Council 2 weeks ago about those three items being in the union contract and being an impediment to him being able to make a meaningful independent investigations in the way the community wants. So they heard from another member of the city bureaucracy that this is a problem. They heard it from the community, and basically their answer is, we're going to deal with body cameras. And we'll talk about body cameras whenever I see you have a question.
Yeah, I'm really interested to hear more about body cameras. But
okay, so it's a very confusing document that the city's going to be voting on. And I should also emphasize to the listeners that they're possibly voting on this contract on Wednesday, October 5, sometime in the morning at the City Council agenda, which starts at 9:30. It's not clear whether they're going to be voting only on some amendments, which I'll talk about in a minute, or if they're going to be voting on the whole package. If they only vote on the amendments, then the whole package might come back on the 12th, unless we convince them you have to put this off.
But you want to turn out people for October 5th at 9:30?
Well, I'm hoping we have a more specific time. It might be not heard until 11 o'clock. But if people have all morning to spend in City Council, if you can get there at 9:30 and stay all the way through, that's great. Portland Cophwatch, we're going to try to put out the word if we find out a more specific time. All right, so what happened with the body cameras is that while they were negotiating all this other stuff in the contract, they were also finalizing a draft body camera policy that the Police Association got to sign off on. And the body camera policy has a clause in it that says an officer is allowed to review their footage before they write their police report, except in deadly force cases. Yeah. So that means, for instance, several years ago, an officer on a horse grabbed a protester by the arm and broke his arm. And if they had body cameras at that point, the officer could have reviewed the body camera footage before he wrote his report.
Formulate a story that...
Right, that justified the behavior. Even though, if it had been deadly force, he wouldn't be able to look at it. So,
other people involved in that incident are not given the benefit of being able to review that footage before they formulate their own testimony.
And that was one of the points that, and I should make that clear, too, that Commissioner Steve Novick made that point from City Council. He said, well, the person who's being charged with a crime should be able to review the footage, too, before they make a statement to the police, to be fair. And he was not met with great enthusiasm. I think that Steve Novick might end up voting no on this whole package because he's upset about that part of the body camera policy. Now, as I said, the body camera policy isn't actually embedded in the contract, but what is part of what they're voting on is a tentative agreement that states the ability to review body camera footage is a mandatory subject of bargaining. Now, this technology has only been around for a couple of years, and I don't know of any court case that has determined that is a mandatory part of bargaining. That it could be what's called permissive, which means you can bargain over it, but it, you know, you don't have to. But the city has taken the position, even though they don't have a legal opinion from a judge, that it's mandatory. So that kind of puts the community in a very rough spot.
So it basically gives the union this kind of bargaining authority to kind of try to ram through certain provisions that allow the police more leeway in terms of...
To review that footage. Mm-hmm. And, you know, ram through is a very good term. So the mayor did, as a result of all the testimony from the ACLU and, all the, and Copwatch and all these other groups on Wednesday, and Don't Shoot Portland, was said, okay, I will amend this to make clear that we're going to create a stakeholder group, and then they're going to have they'll be able to weigh in on the body camera policy. But the end of his amendment paragraph says, and then those proposals will go back to the police association and the police bureau for finalization. So they still get the veto power.
Well, I'm begging the question of who's involved in the stakeholder.
Right. Well, it doesn't really matter. I mean, we can have the greatest lawyer ever, you know, to ever walk the face of the earth sitting on that, and we'll hand over a really great policy that's, you know, perfect, exact what the community wants, and then the police association can just say, nope, shh, and rip it up and start again. And we could be back where we are. So I found it. We put out an email Friday afternoon that says we found this very insulting, that the mayor would waste everybody's time. You know, what he needs to do is have the PPA, the police association, and the bureau at the table, and we'll vote together on what the bureau thing's going to be, and no changes after the group makes their decision. That's the way to do it, to make a policy that the public can have confidence in. But he's not going to do that. So as I mentioned, too, 2 weeks ago they were considering changes to the oversight system. So what our demands are is that they take out those things, those provisions of the contract that prohibit accountability, that let officers get rehired after they're fired for, you know, when it's good cause, that prohibit our independent police review division from compelling officer testimony and our citizen review committee from hearing deadly force cases. And we also have been saying for a long time they should also require officers who are involved in excessive and deadly force incidents to undergo a drug test. Federal guidelines say that if you're a truck driver and you're in an accident that injures somebody, that you have to go to a drug test. Why an officer's shoot or kill somebody, they don't have to go through a drug test? I don't understand it.
So those are federal guidelines.
That's a federal guideline for truck drivers, yep. Uh-huh. So it just seems to make a lot of sense for our local community to do it that way. I also want to put out there and let cable listeners know that in the days after the council hearing that happened on Wednesday, September 28th, Mayor Hales invited some of the groups that testified, but not Portland Cop Watch, to come into his office for one-on-one discussions and with the intention of breaking off their opposition to the contract. His arguments are that there are members of the community who are crying out for more police officers, and because we're giving this extra money to the police, that you are slapping the face of the people that want more cops. Well, if they had invited them to the table, they'd probably be some of the same people who are also saying, we shall hold the police accountable. And maybe they didn't understand that, you know, giving more money to the police to attract new police officers is not being done in exchange for us getting more accountability. If they had understood that, maybe they would be on our side. And he's trying to say that, oh, crime is up, which isn't true. The number of shootings is up, and the number of traffic accidents is up. And it's like, how is more police officers going to stop a traffic accident? That's why it's called an accident. So he used an example. I heard this from one of the people who went to one of these meetings. That woman that was killed, the young girl that was killed by a car on the Hawthorne. How would more police officers have stopped that from happening? I mean, it just doesn't make any sense. So the other main overarching thing that almost everybody said who came up to testify on Wednesday is that Ted Wheeler is going to be the mayor and the police commissioner in January. The current contract doesn't expire until June of next year. This contract will be locked in until 2020, when the next mayor's race is underway. So the new mayor will not have the ability to create the policies that he's going to be able to guide the police bureau in, because this current mayor is trying to create a legacy for himself, you know, create this boom for the cops in terms of money and make no changes of any substance to accountability issues.
So do we need to be calling into the mayor's office and creating flack around this and really insisting that that Hales is not the one who presides over this contract negotiation, that it minimally it needs to go to Wheeler's tenure.
That would be an excellent message if people called the mayor's office. They should also call the other commissioners as well, because he needs three votes to pass this. So it sounded like Steve Novick maybe might be opposed to it. We could probably convince two other commissioners not to vote for it. So I think it would be a good idea for people to call up city council and say, hey, don't pass this contract. It's premature. It's not fixing accountability problems. It's giving away too much. We have nothing less to negotiate with to get these other things that we want changed, and it would help us fulfill the Department of Justice investigation that we've been under since 2012 if we made some of those changes. The other thing is, procedurally, it's very confusing. Because the mayor introduced these amendments that say that he's going to create a stakeholder group, it's possible but not certain that he will take testimony on just those amendments on Wednesday. So people should ask that the mayor allow there to be testimony in the amendments. And the bad news is that if they get the amendments passed, they could attach what's called an emergency ordinance to this, making it so instead of having to kick it to the next week, if he has a unanimous vote, they could vote on it on Wednesday. What I'm hoping to do is delay this and get it kicked over to Mayor Wheeler.
Okay. Well, Dan, thank you so much for coming in and talking with us today. So just to review, you want to turn out people for the October 5th City Council hearing?
At which they're going to be voting on an amendment to a side agreement to the Police Association contract that would let a stakeholder group look at body cameras. It's inadequate to do that. We need a lot more changes.
Okay,
so we need people down there.
And we also need calls and emails to the mayor's office and to the members of the city council to defer the negotiation on this contract, to defer any contract settlement until Ted Wheeler's administration. Dan, thank you so much for coming in to speak with me today.
Sure. If people want more information, they can call 503-236-3065.
Okay, and my guest today has been Dan Handelman of Portland Cop Watch and Peace and Justice Works. This has been Desiree Helligers for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Rock the Nation. Rock the Nation. Rock the Nation. Rock the Nation.
An aggressive time, a painful time, a time where cynicism rots the vine, and a time where violence blocks the sunshine. Lifetimes go by in a flash, in a search for love, in a search for cash. Everybody wanna be some fat tycoon, everybody wanna be on a tropic honeymoon. Nobody wanna sing a little bit out of tune, or be the backbone of a rebel platoon. It's too soon to step out of line. You might get laughed at, you might get fined, but do you fear me when I say I feel pain every day when I see the way my friends gotta slay and never get ahead of bills they gotta pay? No way, no way. Some make a living doing killing, Colombian penicillin. Some are willing to play the villain, they just chilling to pass the time, pass the information, or pass the wine, pass the buck, or pass the baton. But you can't pass the police or the Pentagon, the IRS or the upper echelon. I think it's time to make a move on the contradiction. Bomb, bomb, rock the nation, take over television and radio station. Bomb, bomb, the truth shall come, give the corporations a complication. Bomb, bomb, rock the nation, take over television and radio station. Bomb, bomb, the truth shall come, give the corporations a complication. Say,
that is Michael Franti and Spearhead, Rock the Nation, from their Stay Human album. That was 2001, and it seems like the rebel platoon is growing over the last 15 years. So we're happy about that. We've got movements from the Dakotas to Black Lives Matter and everything in between. And Lori Messier is here to talk with Michael Harriet just about these movements and the issues we're facing around police violence. Lori?
Thanks, Denise. Michael Harriet is a writer, podcaster, spoken word poet, and host of the Black One podcast, which has grown to become one of the most listened to podcasts in Black America. In 2008, he released his first novel, The Situation in South Carolina, to critical success. And last January, he launched his latest venture, Negus Who Read, a hub for information, opinion, and ideas for Black thinkers. Welcome to KBOO, Michael.
Thank you for having me.
You are an amazingly incisive and prolific writer. Your commentary seem to be everywhere. And although some of your pieces have generated controversy, it seems to me that you are stating the obvious about the hypocrisy of the American state and media and how most white Americans just don't get it about the day-to-day indignities, repression, and violence that black people experience. Let's start with a basic fact that you discussed recently in Ebony. Do black people enjoy the same constitutional rights as other Americans?
Well, I think it's the piece that you're speaking of. I went through all of the amendments in the first 10 amendments in the Bill of Rights. And what I spoke about was listing them one by one and, you know, giving examples where black people don't enjoy the same freedoms or the same access to those Bill of Rights that regular Americans do. And, you know, it's evident. I'd like to approach things from, I teach a course called Race as an Economic Construct. So I don't approach things through popular sentiment. I approach them through numbers, facts, and research. And so most of what I say, I try to back up with evidence, with statistical evidence, with research. And so, it's evident that we don't enjoy a lot of those rights that most Americans enjoy.
And that seems very obvious, and a lot of your writing is just the underscoring of those kinds of facts and contrasting the rights that some Americans might receive versus black Americans. And in particular, the Second Amendment, as you have written, it's almost reified as a part of our culture. But the NRA has never rushed into the defense of black people murdered by police under the pretense of carrying a weapon in an open carry state. So, but yet there's this widespread image and understanding that guns protect blacks, given that the state does not. And you've noted that Malcolm X and the Black Panthers frequently noted that the Second Amendment was the only right that blacks had. And there's an influential book by Charles Cobb about how guns kept people alive in the civil rights movement. But you argue that it is laws that govern firearms that offer protection.
Right. So we have to note, first of all, that the Second Amendment historically was never used as as an individual right. It was always thought of as a collective right of the people to protect themselves against a tyrannical government until right after the Civil War, when African Americans enjoying their full citizenship started buying guns, and there arose an opposite force to stop them from owning guns. And that force eventually grew to be called the Ku Klux Klan. The Ku Klux Klan was originally organization whose main goal was to stop African Americans from arming themselves. And the Second Amendment was first argued as an individual right by black people because we had to protect ourselves from what we call now the state, because the state, these lynch mobs, when you look at the history of lynching in the South and in Middle America, in the Midwest, that was the government to black people. And the only protection we enjoyed was the individual right to arm ourselves. So it's a right that we've always held dear, and it's important to look at that aspect in the historical context of black protection against the state.
Even though often people, even Martin Luther King Jr., when applying for a concealed weapon permit, was denied that right.
Right. Martin Luther King was denied that right. The rise of the Black Panthers in Oakland was initially about denying African Americans the right to own guns. You know, the first major restriction of gun rights in America was in California when they wanted to restrict the gun rights because of the threat, that they called it, of the Black Panthers and the Black Panther Party going up, following police when they arrested or detained black people.
Right, right. And you point out that the average American is 58 times more likely to be killed by a cop than a terrorist, and that Americans are more likely to be killed by police or other gun violence?
So, you know, there's an article that just came out today that I wrote for The Root, and it lists most Americans' fears: killed by terrorists, killed by armed robbers. And what I point out is that all of those things are less likely than a black person being killed by police. You know, ProPublica did an article or a statistical research about 2 years ago that showed that the average black male is 21 times more likely to be killed by a police officer than a white person. And all of the statistical research bears it out, that the most of the things that we fear are far less likely to happen than a black person just walking down the street being killed by police.
Yeah. And you also use those statistics to marshal evidence to point out how gun control really does help protect black communities. Do you want to say more about
right.
that?
Right, because like when we talk about, for instance, the buzzword now in all of politics and all of the discussion about Black Lives Matter and black violence, they always go to Chicago, and they point out the number of murders in Chicago. And when you look at the research, while there are a lot of murders in Chicago, Chicago isn't listed in the top 10 most dangerous cities for gun violence. And that's because simply there are a lot of people in Chicago. Chicago has a higher murder rate than New York or Los Angeles, which are the only two cities that are bigger than Chicago. And you have to ask yourself, well, why is Chicago's rate of violence higher than those two big cities? Well, California and New York have very strict gun laws. And so Illinois doesn't have those gun laws, and that accounts for the predominance in violence in that state versus other big cities.
And you note the context for the passage of the Gun Control Act in 1968, which on the heels of uprisings in cities across the country in the aftermath of Martin Luther King Jr.'s assassination. And ironically, the death rate from gun violence dropped pretty significantly in black communities. But that was a figure that the Clinton administration and others tended to ignore when repealing some of those gun controls much later. Is that correct?
Yes. There are a few misconceptions about gun laws, because every time we see a mass shooting, there are a few things that we want to put on the books concerning gun laws. And those things statistically never work. For instance, if we stop people from owning semi-automatic weapons, it surprised me when I researched it that there aren't really a lot of mass killings done with semi-automatic weapons. It's it's popular sentiment that makes us think these things shouldn't be on the street. But even if we restricted semi-automatic weapons, for instance, it wouldn't really signal a result in a big drop in gun violence, because most gun violence is done with a concealed weapon, a pistol. So if we want to stop more gun violence, and if we want to work from big to small, what we'd have to do is restrict the ownership of concealed weapons, small handguns. And that's what causes most gun violence.
Well, you also talk about how at the root of violence against black people, irregardless of gun violence within black communities, that at the root of police violence, or even the fact that Americans ignore the need for gun control, is the white fright, the fact that white Americans have this fear, and this is, of course, a deeply ingrained fear from centuries of propaganda, that police tend to perpetuate in their communities, in urban police forces. Do you want to say more about this phenomenon of white fright and how the kind of violence that has emanated towards black people have come from this deep-rooted fear?
Yeah, I think it's a combination of two things. I think it's one of it is just our natural reaction to seeing, because when you watch TV and, for instance, if you saw four murders and two were committed by blacks and two were committed by whites, the white guys who committed the murder are just guys who committed the murder. The black guys are black guys who committed murder. So naturally, we tend to associate violence when we see black people committed with, he did that because he's a black guy, right? So it's a little bit of propaganda, but it's a little bit of what I call white fright, the irrational fear of black people or things that will happen to a white person because black people will do it. And when we talk about that, we have to realize, and this is the biggest statistic that no one ever talks about. Every statistical analysis, the Bureau of Justice Statistics comes out every year and shows that violence and crime is basically a socioeconomic phenomenon. The more poor black people who are poor and white people who are poor commit crimes at the same rate. Black people who are middle class, white people who are middle class commit crimes at about the same rate. And it goes up for every economic class. So crime has never been a racial phenomenon. It's a socioeconomic phenomenon, which is why America never asks itself, well, if that is true, why are there so many poor black people? That is the root of the question that we should be asking ourselves. We, during this presidential debate, I noticed when they started talking about race in the last debate, they immediately went to crime. Like, when they talked, they said, let's talk about black people, and both candidates immediately started talking about crime. And there is one thing that they never brought up. Why in a country as rich and as powerful and as progressive as America is, that promises freedom for everybody, why do we even just as a matter of factly talk about black neighborhoods? Why is there still a thing called black neighborhoods in a country that is supposed to be free? We never talk about the history of redlining and segregation as it relates to crime.
Right, right. There's not anything about the structural racism that creates that kind of the economic disparities and targeting of black communities, all having to do with the kinds of disparities that you're emphasizing. Michael Harriet, just in the few minutes that we have remaining, want to talk about your media activism, because we've been talking about protests in the streets and the rise of Black Lives Matter, which is such a hopeful movement. But you've been carrying on these subversive protests online. Can you talk a bit about some of your work with your podcast and other media journalism that's having such an impact?
Well, I began doing all of this, the podcast, a lot of the writing, in response to a lack of balance in voices. Lately, there's been a conversation amongst journalists about why there are so few journalists in the forefront of the media. You know, when you talk about the 24-hour cable news networks, there are very few black anchors, for instance. And so I don't think there's a balance of voices, which goes back to what we were talking about earlier, the propaganda or misconceptions about black neighborhoods, black people in general, how we are supposedly predisposed to violence. And we don't have the equality of representation in the media. And I think that's important, right? So if America is going to have a conversation about race, and it is always white people who are engaging us in the conversation, then it really isn't an equal conversation, because both sides aren't represented.
Well,
Go ahead.
Thanks so much. I'm sorry, Michael Harriet, we've run out of time, but thanks so much for speaking with us today on the Old Mole Variety Hour. And we'll post a link to your website, michaelharriet.com. And listeners can find Michael Harriet's writing in a variety of online publications, including Very Smart Brothers, The Root, Deadspin, and Ebony.
Thank you for having me.
There's a new world coming, and it's just around the bend. there's a new world coming. This one's coming to an end. There's a new voice calling, and you can hear it if you try. And it's growing stronger with every day that passes by. Yeah, yeah, yeah. There's a brand new morning rising clear and sweet and free. There's a new day dawning that belongs to you and me. Yes, a new world's coming. You know the one I'm talking about, the one we've had visions of.
That is Nina Simone, New World Coming, from the album Here Comes the Sun, 1971. Well, this morning we've been talking about police violence and activism in art and media, politics, and there's more to be said, of course, on these subjects, and the Old Mole will continue to monitor and discuss the horrific and also the positive and enlightening. I'm Denise Morris for the Old Mole Variety Hour. Thanks for tuning in this morning, and as you know, it is a collective labor that brings you the Old Mole every Monday morning at 9 a.m., and I want to thank our Old Moles, Laurie Mercier, Bill Resnick, and Desiree Helliger as their guests, Teresa Rayford, Michael Harriet, and Dan Handelman. This is the Old Mole Variety Hour. We're signing off for October 3rd. We'll be back again next week.